From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
There's an old expression in gardening, a folksy piece of advice that states, don't fight the sight. Today's guest, James Golden, has been guided by a more nuanced version of that idea in creating a much-praised garden, a wildish, unexpected landscape in New Jersey called Federal Twist that was even featured on the hit BBC program Gardener's World with Monty Don. I've been reading James's new book about Federal Twist, and just like that old garden adage, a lot of James's philosophy of garden making is about acceptance, about letting the place tell you what it wants to be. More in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
James Golden came to garden making later in life when he was preparing to retire from a writing job in the corporate world. His new book is The View from Federal Twist, a new way of thinking about gardens, nature, and ourselves. And I'm pleased to welcome him to the program today. Hey, James, how are you?
Hi, Margaret. I'm great.
Winter. It's winter.
Winter. I just went out to see if my anomalous Yelena was blooming yesterday morning.
Oh, you have that one too. That's the first one to always bloom for me.
Yeah, it's my only one because they hate my soil conditions, so I have to grow it at the top of a stone wall.
So before we get started, to celebrate the book, I know you're going to be doing some virtual lectures in the coming weeks for Wave Hill Public Garden in New York City and for Innisfree Garden in Millbrook, New York, and I'll have information on those events with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com, along with a book giveaway that I'm going to do. So congratulations on the book, which I believe is officially out in the United States March 1st. Is that right?
I hear it's officially out March 1st, yes.
Okay. So set the scene for us with like a little history. When did you start making Federal Twist and how big is the place? What was the blank canvas? You know, just set the scene.
Phil, my husband and I have lived in Brooklyn for years. We decided to look for a house in the country. And we, of course, in our area, we're looking for an 18th century stone house. But I saw an ad for a modern house that was the claim to be Frank Lloyd Wright-like. So we took a look at it and actually loved the place. It was built in 1965, so it's basically sort of mid-century. It has a wall of windows looking out on what then was a monoculture of junipers. And we decided to buy the house, though I had serious reservations about the land as a place for a garden. Mm. I knew it was a bad place for a garden. I knew it was a horrible place for a garden. But for some reason, I just knew I would make a garden here. I didn't know how, but I was very confident that I would make a garden.
So you say horrible place for a garden because soil or drainage or what?
First, there was no open space, so we had to cut down about 70 or 80 junipers.
Uh-huh, the native eastern red cedars, the ones that, are kind of ubiquitous. Yeah, mm-hmm.
And, you know, originally, the house had an open field behind it, so I was, in a sense, restoring the land to the conditions when the house was built. Mm-hmm. But the soil was heavy, heavy, wet clay. It doesn't percolate at all. The water just runs over the surface. If you dig a hole, the water stays in the hole for days. There's a huge amount of stone under the surface. So the plants that can be grown here are very limited.
Mm. So as I said in the introduction, sort of a theme that, you know, speaking of of limitations and so forth, and reality checks, a theme that repeats throughout the book, is one of acceptance. And so, you know, you said you knew, you say in the book that you knew, looking at this wet clay, and I think you describe it as having a rough, coarse nature, the site, you say you knew that it would be an ecological garden that you would make because of what you were, what you saw, and accepting what you saw.
I knew that only plants adapted to this ecology could grow here.
Right.
I had to find out what many of those were, and I did a lot of experimentation in the early days. I also had a visual picture. I was, at the time, in love with Pete Audolph's gardens. And I wanted something like that, but I quickly discovered I couldn't have that. I would have to have my version.
And so his gardens, they're certainly not in a heavy clay, wet situation, right?
No, they're on very well prepared soil, and they're planned very carefully and maintained very carefully, because Pete does not want his plants moving around.
Ah,
his gardens aren't wild at all; they just look wild.
Right. So you know, I hate to say it as a longtime gardener, but traditionally gardening is really about exerting control over a space, you know, about dominating it with the human hand, to, especially if you want to achieve formal effects. And as I've said to you before in our correspondence, you know, it's not about acceptance of the place, but sort of unacceptance, really. You know, it's imposing something. And so you say in the book, acceptance is the key to creating a garden that felt right in its place. So what did you knew it would be an ecological garden. Did you have any other sort of instincts early on in making it? What about what year was this that you began the garden? I'm sorry, I forgot to ask that.
We bought the house in Leiden, 2004, and I started clearing the trees in spring of 2005.
Oh?
That was the starting point. I also started my gardening blog called View from Federal Twist at that time.
Yes, I remember.
Which is sort of where the name of the garden comes from.
And Federal Twist because?
Because we live on Federal Twist Road.
Okay, because it's certainly not a Federalist house or anything.
No. And no one knows why the road has this name.
Ah, yeah. You know, you talk a lot about wildness also in the book, and you just referred to someone who doesn't want his plants to move about, but you say, I wanted my plants to move about. So tell us about sort of some of the other sort of principles or the guidance. Like, how did you even, you know, the way you describe it, tough soil, tough site, a forest of Eastern red cedars, you know, it's like, how did you... What did you start with, like a path, or do you know what I mean? Like what revealed itself to you, or where was the beginning?
I actually did start with a path, but before that, I had to have some sort of method for controlling the ground surface.
Ah.
And I was at the time reading, you know, Pete Audolph's books, many of which were actually written by Noel Kingsbury. And I was reading in one of Noel's early books about planting directly into rough grass. And he recommended digging a big hole, buying a big competitive plant, putting it in the hole, actually doing that many times over. And I took that advice, and it worked. I planted many large prairie plants and other plants too that quickly shaded out the lower growth. Not all of the lower growth. There's still lots of native carexes and lots of equisetum and other plants that existed here then. But that method was critical to making the garden work and giving me something I could control with limited labor.
So you did not remove existing vegetation, other than that you opened up the space where that had been dense trees, the conifers. You didn't remove the existing herbaceous or whatever vegetation, the ground level vegetation. You planted into it.
I just mowed it and then started planting into it.
Wow.
And then initially, with no sense of design, I was just experimenting to see what would grow. I discovered, for example, that Monarda, such a common plant, really can't grow in my conditions. So I just got everything I could find, really, to see what I could grow in this place.
So it was kind of a buffet. You experimented and saw who survived.
And then I sort of had a developing chaos and couldn't get a good idea for a design. So I got really frustrated one summer day and got out the mower. I don't have a mower now. And mowed a curvy path across the middle of the field.
Oh.
And it was like an epiphany. Suddenly, the garden sort of began to come to life. I was able to see slight changes in topography, where the mower cut weeds open at the edge of the pathway. I could see into the inner structure of the weed and how they rooted into the earth. And I felt that I knew the place for the first time. That was really a sort of a magical moment for me.
It's interesting that you say that because it reminds me again of another sort of old piece of garden, quote, wisdom, which was, you know, when people would be like, well, when I'm getting started, how do I know where to make my paths? And there was this, and I don't know who first suggested it, but it was like, watch where your dog goes from here to there. Take the path that your dog takes. Like, how animals know the terrain, do you know what I mean? And they have like an instinct or whatever. It's not necessarily the shortest distance between two points, but they take the best route. And so you didn't watch a dog do it, but you got that mower out and made a path. That's great. And it really revealed so much.
And then eventually I had many, many paths. So.
Right. And you talk about, again, in the book, you talk about, you know, like you've been saying, the wildness and so forth and of this place, but you juxtaposed elements of structure against that. You didn't, the path being probably, it's not literally structure, but just by mowing it, but it is in a way. So you sort of juxtaposed structural elements against this looser, wild nature of the place.
Appropriate structural elements. We have a lot of native stone in this area. As a matter of fact, we have had a huge supply along both sides of the property line of a stone called argillite, which is a sort of gray, somber stone. The old timers, boy, I should be an old timer now, but
I'm with you, James.
The old timers call it blue jingle or blue jingler because if you hit the rocks together, they tend to ring. And we had a huge supply of it, so I think we built several hundred feet of very roughly laid stone wall, which are an important part of the garden structure. And since I've added a stone circle and numerous sitting areas. And a couple of very, very low-impact, subtle sculptures. They're dark bronze, and they're very simple, so they sort of blend into the background and have more or less organic shapes.
One other sculptural, in quotes, element that I loved, which was surprising seeing the pictures in the book. So there's all this looseness, and then there are sometimes a grouping of vertical conifers, very, you know, tight conifers, like a little cluster of exclamation points. I don't know how many places that repeats itself, but I saw at least one.
Of course, and then I called them Thuja occidentalis because I hate to say that they're arborvitae.
Right.
But it's an evergreen that is extremely well adapted to my soil conditions.
Oh.
And they love the wet.
Interesting, interesting. And they're just so emphatic. And so here is this one of the plantings, one of the areas I loved seeing, and it's a plant I've only seen in Wisconsin at like University of Madison's Prairie Restoration and thereabouts in nature. It's the only time I've seen it. In mass, like you have this big mass of what's called Queen of the Prairie, Filipendula rubra. Yeah. And, you know, it's just not a plant that I see gardeners use. So how did, was that one of your experiment plants that then thrived and got a permanent spot because of it?
It was. This was, you know, the early 2000s. And frankly, I couldn't find very many good nurseries around here. So I was really struggling to find plants. I couldn't use plugs because plugs tend to just vanish in the growth in my garden.
Right, little tiny plants, right, right.
And I found a nursery called Paxson Hill Farm just across the river in Bucks County. A guy named Bruce Gangawar, who is a garden designer and uses a nursery more or less to store plants. He gets in really unusual things that I couldn't find anywhere else. And I found this big supply of big pots of Filipendula rubra venusta. So I had only seen pictures of it. I'd never actually seen the plant flowering. But I got 30 or 40 of them and planted them across a wide swath. And amazingly, they have remained stable since the garden started. And they flower profusely every June in that Pepto-Bismol pink.
I know, they're crazy, right? And they're not little guys. They're tall.
But they have beautiful structure.
Yeah.
They have beautiful foliage. And they're actually prettier after they flower, when the flower heads turn a sort of bronzy color.
Oh, okay. I've never seen them at that moment. So it feels like, from the pictures in the book and so forth, it feels like you found that not just starting with big plants, as in larger sized plants, but plants that have stature, that can stand up to the situation. You have a lot of bold or tall kind of plants, do you? Is that true, or is that just my
looking? That's
at the pictures?
True. And yeah. I often look for people just to, so to give a sense of scale in photographs.
Right.
Much of the planting by midsummer is above head height. So when I have a garden conservancy open day, it's not infrequent that someone comes up to me and tells me they're lost and they don't know where to go.
And you probably love that. You love that.
I do. There may be another path 6 feet away, but because the plants are so tall, they just can't find it. Anyone who is willing to just explore the garden will find their way through, and that's sort of my intent. I didn't want to confuse people. I just wanted to encourage them to explore and not ask me which way to go, because there is no way to go.
Right. Right. It's not like an alley that leads one place and that's the end of it, right? It's not that kind of formality and one destination.
I have to say that I don't like formal gardens. I do, but I couldn't have one in this crazy place.
Right. Other plants, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of ornamental grasses, big stature grasses. Other plants that you found have worked for this sense of wildness and also the site, you know, the soil and so forth.
I have a lot of grasses. They're very important. And I wanted to use lots of American grasses like panicums. But I discovered, at least until now, I haven't found many native grasses that can do well over the long term in my highly competitive conditions. Panicums do well for a few years, and the larger ones like Dallas Blues, which is pretty big, last a lot longer. But they seem to be more less resilient and more inclined to be invaded by other plants from the side, and then they just gradually disappear.
Right.
So one grass I have almost too much of is Miscanthus, mm-hmm. various sorts. And it may be a Japanese grass, but it looks to me entirely appropriate in this place.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of Miscanthus giganteus for screening some areas. I have a deer fence, so I need to screen the deer fence at different
right.
times of the year.
I use the giganteus. I have a big mass of it, and I use it to screen my compost heap and those sort of work areas and the far driveway. Like, so when I'm looking out across the garden, it's like a seasonal wall of,
yes.
you know, yeah. And it creates invisibility beyond. So yeah, it's great for that. The good thing about that one for me is I'm farther north than you are. I'm a zone 5. I think you're a little bit warmer, but not warm, but is that it doesn't seed in, you know, that's not one that I've ever, and I've had it for more than 25 years. I never had a seeding problem with it. So that's good.
I have had one plant seed in.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
From the giganteus.
Oh, uh-huh.
The others do seed in, and I just have to keep an eye out.
Yeah. No, I know.
While they're little.
I know. Any other, like the way the filipendula is such a strong character in the garden. Any other particular favorites among the forbs, among the flowering plants?
Silphium perfolium.
Oh, yes.
Silphium terebinthinaceum, Silphium laciniata.
I can't remember. I mean, one is the cup plant. One is the, I can't remember the common names of the Silphiums.
Perfoliatum is the cup plant.
Yeah.
Terebinthinaceum has the big shovel-shaped leaf that feels like sandpaper.
Ah.
And Laciniatum has the deeply cut, huge leaves, some like in my garden, 30 inches long. And some are 8 to 10 feet tall.
Yes.
They always fall over eventually. But.
And these are prairie natives as well from our American prairies.
They are. And
yeah.
One plant that looks very well with them is not a prairie native at all. It's an Inula, Inula racemosa zonenspier, which was, I think, introduced by Wolfgang Irma of Irma and Van Sweden Associates.
Yes, yes.
I read something about him. I know he was a sort of wild and crazy plantsman. And I read something about his using this plant, and I found it in a little nursery in British Columbia. I think it was called Blue Stem.
Oh, yeah.
I ordered a couple one year just as an experiment, and lo and behold, they seed like crazy, which might frighten many gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
But I've discovered if you pay attention, you can keep the plant from escaping. And I think they seed like that for a reason, because they tend to be sort of short-lived plants. They grow up to be, you know, some I think are 12 and 14 feet tall. That's the extreme. But they get very large. And then each year they get smaller.
Mm.
I think they have short lives. Mm. But the plant is beautiful, and it's a beautiful winter plant. It has a fabulous structure. It's very sculptural in the winter. They sort of turn this skeletal black, very, very atmospheric. It's one of my favorite plants.
Mm. Well, we're almost out of time, and I just wanted to not fall victim to the thing that Monty Don forgot to ask you about, apparently, at your interview, which is that you said you hate gardening. Is that a true thing?
I don't like the labor of gardening. I grew up in the South, so I should be used to heat, but I like gardening from a distance and having someone to do what I want done.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm getting to the help. I like having help too. I still like rooting around, and I love weeding, but I think that's not your thing.
I sort of enjoy pulling Japanese still grass.
Oh boy, yes. Let's subdue that wicked devil. Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, the book is lovely. Did you take the pictures?
I took all of the pictures except for the cover, which was done by Claire Takash.
Ah, yes. Well, it's beautiful, and as I said at the beginning, it just, it's just making me think about exerting less control and letting the place speak to us. And I think very, 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 it's full of very good philosophical advice as well as practical advice and plant inspiration. So thank you, and thanks for making time, James, this morning to talk. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Margaret. I enjoyed it very much.
Okay. Talk to you soon again, I hope.
Bye-bye.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
And I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, I hope, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.